Now, our reading was Psalm 137, which began with the words, "By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and wept." So we're going to begin with a song over our sound system, which just happens to begin with the words, "By the rivers of Babylon." So I invite you, hot evening, just to sit and relax as we listen together.
By the rivers of Babylon, there we
Now, if you listen to those words sung by Boney M., and also you look down at Psalm 137 at the same time, try and compare the two, because the words are similar, almost identical, and yet not the tone. As sung by Boney M., the tune is happy, and it's smiley, and it's relaxed. And as long as you have a general liking for this kind of music, it makes you feel good. And in the Boney M. song video, which you may remember from the past, there is dancing and swaying and limbo dancing and all the rest. It's all a very happy mood. And yet, Psalm 137 itself, which presumably was the basis of that song, is very different. In fact, there's not a song to sing. It's more a cry of pain. If you look at the very first verse, it says, "By the rivers of Babylon, we didn't sing and dance. No, we sat and wept." This wasn't a holiday. We're talking about very grim history, the events of 587 BC. And if you know your history, you'll realize that the Babylonian army in that year razed Jerusalem to the ground, Zion, the holy city. And it was left simply a heap of ruins. The walls have been broken down, the palaces and the houses have been destroyed, and perhaps most significant of all, the temple of the Lord had been completely burned down. And then many of the people who were there were taken off to Babylon as exiles. This was a forced relocation. So as we look at this psalm, we're actually asking ourselves, how did it feel to be a Jewish exile in Babylon with all of that? Well, as you look at verse 2, you'll see that singing about it was out of the question. "There on the poplars we hung our harps." Just a few years ago now, I was in a shoe shop trying on a new pair of shoes in Somerset, when the man who owned the shop suddenly stopped serving me and he said, "Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to leave you for a few moments because I understand that a great old friend of mine is outside in a car and I just don't want to miss the chance to say hello." So he left me in my socks, and off he disappeared. And after about 5-10 minutes, perhaps it might have been, he returned. And the man that he went to see, as he explained later, was called Harry Patch, who died in July. And he's been all over the papers recently because he was the last man to have personal experience of being a soldier in the trenches of the First World War. Now, in recent years, he had talked about the horrors of that battle. But it had taken him until he was 100 years old. He died at 111. He was 100 before he actually would say anything at all about his experiences that had happened in those trenches 80 years previously. Now, I suspect that was something how these people felt. The Jews in Babylon could remember well enough, but they could not talk about it, and they certainly could not sing. Their musical instruments were silent. So the only sound that they were making was, if you like, a cry of anguish. Verses 1 to 4. On one hand, they were haunted by their memories. Let me read a description of what it felt like to one of the other psalm writers, what they remembered. "O God, the nations have invaded your inheritance. They have defiled your holy temple. They have reduced Jerusalem to rubble. They have given the dead bodies of your servants as food to the birds of the air, the flesh of your saints to the beasts of the earth. They have poured out blood like water all around Jerusalem, and there is no one to bury the dead. But as we say, to add insult to injury, they were also not only haunted by these appalling memories, but they were taunted by their captors. Look at that in verse 3. It says, "For there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, 'Sing us one of the songs of Zion.'" And to be asked to do that was torture. The same kind of cruelty was repeated in the death camp at Treblinka in the Second World War, where Jews were forced to sing and dance of their Jewishness. As one commentator wrote about that, he said, "It was designed to rob Jews of their identity, their dignity, and their hope." Just the other day, a leader on the side of the Taliban in Afghanistan was taunting the British forces there when he said, and perhaps you heard it on the news, he said, "All they have achieved in the last 8 years is carrying coffins." The cry of anguish was not a complaint about their living conditions or simply a feeling of homesickness. It was brought on by the haunting memory of what had been done to Jerusalem, the holy city, and the added taunting of their Babylonian gods. But that all seems rather a long time ago now. So what does that say to those of us who have never experienced anything quite like that? I think it first says that we should not be ashamed of ever being what I might call deep in tears. It's very important that we understand that the Psalms are not only there to express our praises or even our fears or our periods of spiritual doubt, but they're also there for when we are crying deep down. And so we can turn to this psalm, for example, when we have wounds inside us of one form or another, the kind of wounds that simply won't heal, the memories that never fade. I found a few pages by Walter Brueggemann, who is an Old Testament professor in the United States, very helpful on this subject in his book on the Psalms. And as he wrote, it was clear that he was very worried that among Christians, as he said, there can often be what he calls a mismatch between our life experience of disorientation and our faith speech of orientation. It seems he's trying to tell us that it's possible to have a church culture where we almost feel under pressure to say and sing things that suggest that everything's all right. And that's why a psalm like this, here it is in the middle of the Bible, is so important for our collection. But it's not just this psalm, the writing of it, that allows us to face raw reality, as Brueggemann puts it, but it's God himself. The God assumed by and addressed in these psalms is a God of sorrows. He's a God who is acquainted with grief. This has nothing to do with doubting God. It is coming to a God where nothing is out of bounds, nothing from our own experience is out of bounds or inappropriate. In fact, when we do come to God in practice, even in this very deathly place in which we are at the time, we can discover new life given us by God. Another quotation from Brueggemann comes across as, I think, very simple and natural and liberating. He says he values psalms like this one because, he says, they are a means of expressing that tries to match experience. Deep in tears. Well, let's move on. What else can we learn? Well, we can learn what it means to be away from home. Not only can we experience those deep wounds and those tears that we've been thinking about of grief of one kind or another, and it doesn't need me to tell you what it is in your own experience where that is the case. It is possible for us to move on, as we call it, and yet still be damaged by what has happened in the past. But it's not only these tears that we learn about here, but there are also ways in which we can find ourselves in a foreign land. If you like, the pain of being away from home. And that's one of the things in this psalm. It says in verse 4, "How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land?" Now, on a bit of a lighter note for a moment, I can feel in a foreign land sometimes at football matches. Friends of mine have been very kind, and they've invited me to their own stadium in Manchester United or Fulham, or Arsenal to watch their football team beat my football team, Manchester City. On one hand, of course, it is a very generous gesture on their behalf. But on the other, it provides them with the pleasure of seeing me utterly humiliated time after time, surrounded by thousands of their own supporters. But there are other ways, perhaps more obvious, in which we can feel in a foreign land, simply by being far from home. Maybe we're feeling that just now. We've come from somewhere else in another part of the world, or even not so far away, and here we are in London. What are we doing here? It's strange. But what is being talked about here is even more significant than that. Because the Jews in Babylon not only felt cut off from home physically, but also spiritually. They were a long way from the temple and everything that seemed in their history to speak of where God was. I was talking with a doctor who had just spent 3 years in China with her husband. The husband was there because of his work for an oil company, and they were there for these 3 years with their two young children. Now, they were very positive about their experience as a whole. They enjoyed it. But she pointed out the differences that they discovered. The legal system, ways in which they felt unprotected, more pollution in the cities. Even their church experience seemed unfamiliar. Men and women were segregated more. There was a Christian culture that felt more legalistic than at home. There was an understanding of the Bible more fundamentalist than perhaps what they were used to. But also, beyond that, there was this awareness that there were thousands of people all around them who probably knew nothing about the God they believed in and Jesus, who meant so much to them. They felt, in a foreign land. Now, without us going to China or coming from China to London, we too can feel, as a follower of Jesus Christ, in a foreign place. We might feel it when we go to work, or if we go into hospital, or if we ever find ourselves in prison. Very often we discover this experience of being in a minority, where we're very conscious that the majority of people around us, perhaps everybody else that we work with, for example, holds secular values, and sometimes just reminds us that they belittle our Christian faith. The Bible explains so clearly that this may be uncomfortable, but it is not surprising. Because we are all exiles. We're all in a foreign land. All Christians are foreigners in another country. Peter told his readers in the New Testament that we are aliens and foreigners. And if we find ourselves in that kind of situation, as we will, let us always remember that we may be away from home, but we are never away from the Lord. He is not left behind. And Ezekiel begins his book by telling the Jewish exiles that he had seen the same vision of God's glory among the exiles in Babylon by the river Kibar as he had done in the temple in Jerusalem. And I think a verse that comes in Ezekiel, I think is quite a good one to take in our luggage. Whenever we're setting off out of range of the fellowship where we have felt so much at home. And we just read this particular verse. It comes from Ezekiel in chapter 11 and verse 16. If you want to find it now, we won't go to all the passages that we're looking at, but that's page 838. I mentioned that because you might like to keep hold of it for a future reference. And as we look down the page on the left-hand side there, we come to a new paragraph, verse 16. Therefore say, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. And remember, this is addressed to exiles. Though I sent them far away among the nations and scattered them among the countries, yet for a little while I have been a sanctuary for them in the countries where they have gone. I have been a sanctuary for them in the countries where they have gone. Now, we spent quite a lot of time on that first cry, and that is the cry of anguish. But there's another cry we're going to read about in verses 5 and 6, the second of these, a cry of resolve. Now, the writer, you can sort of tell how he's feeling just from those first few verses. He could have reacted to all this in complete despair, but he didn't. In fact, as we read verses 5 and 6, we find a degree of aggression. Here was somebody who, in the face of everything, was defiant. There was a lot of grit about the way that the psalm writer wrote. And we can feel this surge of commitment, of loyalty, that will resist all the pressures and win through against all the odds. Let me read verses 5 and 6. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. We're back in Psalm 137. It's a vow. It's a solemn vow. It's underlined. It's signed with a pledge. But what does it have to say to us in our context? I think, first of all, that wherever we are and whatever's going on around us, we are determined to stand. Now, again, on a slightly lighter note, there's a story of this young boy starting at boarding school. You may have heard it. It's one of those rather corny ones. But at the end of term, his parents were very interested to receive his school report. And the report included a health check from the school nurse. Height at start of term, 5'3". Height at end of term, 5'2". Followed by the headmaster's own report, Freddie is settling down nicely. But as Christians, we're not to be content with just settling down nicely. Sometimes we can settle down nicely thinking that everything's going wrong. And it's so encouraging to look down at verse 5 and 6 and to see somebody who, against everything that was happening in the background, was prepared to resolve, to stand, determined to stand with God. It's one thing to allow ourselves to feel those toughest experiences that lead us to tears and to take them seriously, to explore our doubts and accept we're always going to have questions. That's one thing. But we always have to be careful that we never fall into a way of believing that leans always in the direction of our questions and our difficulties. It can become a habit. And it therefore fails to look forward with confidence in God and resolve that nothing will deter us from following Jesus Christ. Being a Christian is not easy, but we must never give in. The doctor I spoke to about their experience in China said that although being away from home was hard, in the end, she said, it forced us both to work out, she and her husband, what our faith in Jesus Christ actually meant, implying it was really the first time they'd done that, when the usual props from home and home churches were no longer there, when not surrounded by the like-minded, as she put it. She said the result was that our faith grew and strengthened. So it's salutary that those with tears are the same people as those who can challenge us to joy. Just think about that, being challenged to joy. Read again verse 6. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. For those exiles, Jerusalem was not just home physically, but was home spiritually. As a place, it stood for their faith in God. And without it, they felt lost, because it represented all God's blessings. And the obvious dream for those people away from home was that one day they would see it restored as a city, to rebuild the temple in its walls, and then again they would feel secure. It was, said the psalm writer, his highest joy. But that's all very well for him and his situation. What about us and ours? How can Jerusalem be our highest joy? I think the answer is that when we see the Bible speaking as our goal, not being a temple or a city of bricks and mortar, but as it goes on, not only in the New Testament, but there are signs of this in the Old as well, but focusing on a new temple who is Jesus himself and a new city, the New Jerusalem. An entry to this new city is not through membership of the Jewish race, although there is nothing to prevent any Jew being part of it, but through the grace of God offered to everybody. John Newton, we may know because he was a man who was a slave trader who became a Christian, and he wrote some extraordinary songs, for example, Amazing Grace. And he was inspired to write about Zion City, in a song that begins, "Glorious things of thee are spoken." Just listen to his last verse. He wrote, "Saviour, since of Zion's city I through grace a member am, let the world deride or pity, I will glory in your name. Fading are the world's best pleasures, all its boasted pomp and show. Solid joys and lasting treasures none but Zion's children know. Jerusalem, my highest joy." And so we come to our last cry. And our last cry, looking at verse 7 to 9, is a cry for justice. There was never any doubt about who was guilty, who had caused these horrors that we've been reading about tonight in Jerusalem. Two enemies were responsible. If you look at verse 7, you'll see that one of them was Edom. "Remember, O Lord, what the people of Edom did on the day that Jerusalem fell." Well, the people of Edom, at first, they just watched the invading armies pour into Jerusalem. But they then became collaborators with the Babylonians as the Edomites too marched in to ravage the city and its inhabitants. Let me just read another little quotation from one of the smaller prophets, which sets the scene. "In that day, declares the Lord, will I not destroy the wise men of Edom, men of understanding in the mountains of Esau? Because of the violence against your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame, you will be destroyed forever. On the day you stood aloof while strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, and you were like one of them. You should not march through the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor look down on them in their calamity in the day of their disaster, nor seize their wealth in the day of their disaster. You should not wait at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives, nor hand over their survivors in the day of their trouble." But of course, the main guilty party was Babylon, who had set themselves to destroy Jerusalem utterly. And here in Psalm 137, the writer calls for justice. And what he demands is for Babylon to be dealt with like for like. Eye for eye, retribution, repayment. This is a call for punishment, a punishment that would mirror what had been done to the Jews. Verses 8 and 9, "O daughter of Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is he who repays you for what you have done to us, he who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks." This was typical of war in those days, and maybe of war or acts of terrorism in any age. Acts that are indiscriminate, brutal, unrestrained, with even children suffering beyond belief. Many of you will know Jenny Brown, who's one of our senior ministers on this team. She and Rachel Cook visited a school at Beslan. Perhaps that name rings a bell, in North Ossetia in the Russian Federation. That was nearly 5 years ago. It was a school that became famous across the world for all the wrong reasons. Because almost exactly 5 years ago, a truckload of men and women armed with Kalashnikovs roared through the school gate. They showed no mercy on parents, teachers, and children. They unleashed the most indescribable horrors. And by the end of the day, more than 330 people, half of them children, were dead. And Jenny wrote, which her visit came just a couple of months after that atrocity, she wrote describing the graveyard. She said, "Here were the temporary wooden crosses stretching into the distance." But she added, "It's not over yet. The people of Beslan are still in the process of identifying and burying their dead." Now, we can be thankful in one way that the psalm writer didn't edit out the cruelty, because it exists. But we're bound to ask at the same time, how can a writer of the Psalms in the Bible call, it seems, for such a bloodthirsty response? Now, if we look into the psalm itself, we're not going to find a satisfying answer. No attempt is made to tack on a couple of verses to reassure us that he didn't mean what he wrote. But without suddenly being made to feel better about it, we would be foolish to ignore what the Bible teaches about justice being done. The psalm is a cry of pain from beginning to end. And it doesn't try to present a complete theological picture. And so before we finish, let's just remember that the Bible does call for justice. In one way, what is written here is not out of place. But it was justice by God. There's no suggestion that these Jews, the people who are weeping by the waters of Babylon, were ever going to take any action themselves against the little ones of Babylon. Their cry was for justice. But justice by the judge himself, by God. And in Jeremiah, God promised that a destroyer would come against Babylon. And later in Revelation, Babylon is the name chosen to describe the total evil that Christ conquers and destroys once and for all. You can read about it. Woe, O great city, O Babylon, it says in Revelation, city of power, in 1 hour your doom has come. But God's instruction to us, quoting the Old Testament in Romans 12, is crystal clear. Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. Vengeance is mine. I will repay. And what is crucial for us when faced with injustice, maybe sometimes very close to home, is to have the ability to turn vengeance over to God and leave it with him. So justice by God, and then finally justice with peace. Now, I'm very well aware that this whole matter of justice and what we're reading in front of us here is impossible just to handle in a few sentences. If you take what's going on at the moment, the release of the Lockerbie bomber, that's taxing the world. It's a very heavy tangle of political and legal and emotional, maybe economic and other issues, all involved. It is very hard to get to the bottom of these things, but at least we can spot a couple of leads from Scripture. And the same Old Testament book that promised justice to the exiles also called them to peace with their new neighbors and captives. Let me just read this from Jeremiah. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Harry Patch, that last survivor from the trenches of the First World War, had, because he died at 111, plenty of time to plan his funeral. And in planning it, he made it very clear that he wanted it based on peace and reconciliation. The German official who was invited to read the lesson at Harry's funeral knew that he had been chosen, as he said, because Harry explicitly wanted his former enemy to be represented at his funeral service. Now, sometimes, as we look at this psalm, we think, yes, rather like this psalm here, so there are times when we can't sing, we can't even speak, we can only cry. And Psalm 137 takes us through our darkest days and our longest memories. And it takes us through with a cry of anguish, a cry of resolve, and a cry for justice. And trusting God with those feelings and those experiences of ours that only He can handle.